Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the, we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I think we'll be in a position to be able to share vaccines as well as know-how with other countries who are in real need.
As COVID cases rip through India and surge across Asia, major faith leaders demand that wealthy countries end vaccine nationalism. I speak with South African Archbishop Thabo Makgoba and Seth Berkley, head of the Global Vaccine Alliance, Gavi. Then, recently I spoke with biographer Blake Bailey about Philip Roth and misogyny. Now, Bailey himself is under fire. I asked journalist and Me Too chronicler Rebecca Traister why this keeps happening. Also, Walter Isaacson looks at white supremacy inside the Department of Homeland Security with former Secretary Jay Johnson, and a celebrated portrait of Breonna Taylor on display at home in Louisville. I speak with the artist, Amy Sherald.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. India continues to break global coronavirus records, and the spike is crushing its public health system as oxygen, hospital beds, and even cremation sites remain desperately scarce.
These raging fires will continue all day and through the evening. The surge in cases has been so much that there's a waiting, really, for these bodies to be put on the pyre by family members. There's a queue outside, just waiting for the final rites to end for a family member who has died of COVID-19. Body after body being brought into this crematorium in India's national capital, New Delhi, that has seen a huge surge, not only in cases, but in fatalities as well.
And as President Joe Biden touts his vaccination record to Congress, his chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, is calling out the U.S. and other wealthy countries for failing to tackle the global nature of this pandemic. And now, almost 150 religious leaders are launching a global campaign to end vaccine nationalism or extreme vaccine inequality. In a joint statement, they say, "We cannot abdicate our responsibilities to our sisters and brothers by imagining that the market can be left to resolve the crisis or pretend to ourselves that we have no obligation to others in our shared humanity." One of those faith leaders is Dr. Thabo Makgoba. He is Southern Africa's Anglican Archbishop, and he's joining me from Cape Town, along with Seth Berkley, who is CEO of Gavi, the Global Vaccine Alliance, which supports immunizing poor countries. He's in Geneva. Gentlemen, welcome both to the program. Can I start with you, Archbishop, because you and your fellow faith leaders of all different religions have signed this letter and this urgent call. You know, up until mid-April, apparently only less than 1% of people have been vaccinated in sub-Saharan Africa. Can you tell me from your own eyes the urgency of the need on your continent?
The urgency is indescribable because if one looks at the COVAX system and its intention, it's supposed to help the global south and the poorest of the poor countries to vaccinate only 3%. It is destined to fail. And in my context, I've seen people die without saying goodbye to their families. And if one looks at the scourge in India in your introduction, one is anxious that should we have that magnitude in the continent will be wiped off the face of this earth, whilst others are hoarding. So this is not a moral issue only, but it is an issue of greed, and it is an issue that the world should really speak up and stand up against such behavior in the face of death, particularly when monopolies are wanting to make capital instead of saving life.
Golly, Archbishop, when you say wiped off the face of this earth, it's a really dramatic picture and it's a dramatic crisis. So let me ask you, Seth Berkley, you know, according to the WHO, I think only 2% of COVID-19 vaccine doses have been administered in Africa. And of course, their population represents 16% of the world. And we've been reporting on this inequity for months now. And as the Archbishop said, rich countries are hoarding. You're concerned with the, you know, with the poor nations and the poorest people. What can actually be done? Promises are being made from the highest levels of power. We've heard President Biden himself.
So thank you, Christiana, for having us and for taking on this important issue. The numbers are terrible. I mean, high-income countries, about a third of the citizens have gotten one dose. In the lowest-income countries, it's 0.2%. Clearly, that is not equity. Now, why was COVAX set up? It was because, you know, this something like this happened in 2009 in the last epidemic, and we wanted to try to do something else. But as the Archbishop has said, what's happened is there have been export bans, there have not been sharing of doses, and this has been a real challenge. So COVAX has been able to procure over 2 billion doses, which will be available by the end of 2021. That should cover 30% of the population, but they're not here today. At the same time, wealthy countries bought more than 1.5 billion doses beyond the amount they need to cover their citizens because they didn't know which vaccines would work. So what we're asking is that right now, at this critical time, they share those doses so that we can make sure that at least the healthcare workers and the highest risk groups get served everywhere in the world, because we're only safe if everybody is safe. And that's the reality of this pandemic and the new variants and the spread that's occurring.
You know, you talk about how healthcare workers, of course, should get vaccinated. I was stunned to hear a WHO official in Africa today say that it's heartbreaking to watch on television or whatever, as she put it, a 19-year-old in a rich global northern country receiving his or her vaccine, where health workers, you know, who are on the front lines of this pandemic in Africa or India or wherever, cannot get even a first dose. So, Archbishop, you, with this letter, are calling, in fact, on the world's most developed leaders, the most powerful G7 leaders, who are coming here to Britain, I think it's in June. You're calling on them to make this a priority and to really get every piece of this puzzle towards sending vaccines to where they're most desperately needed right now. Do you think your message is going to get through?
I'm hoping this message and through your programs and many other voices and people of faith and no faith, the G7 will listen. Because look at it this way. I was working in Lesotho over the weekend, and I had my mask, and I had to do the testing because I was crossing the border. And lo and behold, at a hotel where I was staying, there were more people with an American accent and an English accent, and they are here. So the pandemic and the coronavirus does not know color. It does not know race. It does not respect the national flags. And I hope that the G7 will realize that we We cannot vaccinate in Europe and think that the variant that comes from other places in India and everywhere will not reach their borders. And we are only safe if everyone is safe. And I want to say also, I mean, Canada is one of the G7. And I was pained that Canada also used the COVAX. Yes, of course, they can, but use the COVAX in the first instance to buy so many vaccines. I would have thought Canada will say, let me go and compete with the others, or let me support the global south to really access more vaccine rather than take vaccines. But to those G7 leaders, please examine your conscience. We are safe together. This is not an apartheid issue where you are driven by capital and monopoly who have already made their profits. Think about life rather than profit.
And of course, at the beginning, that was the pledge, wasn't it, Seth Berkley? It was going to be, you know, intellectual property was going to be shared, the patents, the, you know, it wasn't going to be about a profit-making motive. I'm stunned to hear that Canada would have accessed vaccines via COVAX, which is meant to be, I thought, for the developing world. Seth, how does that happen?
Well, actually, Christiana, the way COVAX was set up was to try to avoid these bilateral deals. And the idea was to have global solidarity and have equitable access. So we invited all countries to join, wealthy countries, you know, upper middle income as well as low income countries. And for low income countries, we were raising finance to make those vaccines available free of charge. The challenge we've had is that because so many doses were locked up at the beginning, we haven't been able to get doses in the first half of the year. We have a large number of doses, as I've mentioned, for the second half of the year. But obviously, we have to oblige the people who have put money on the table to buy doses, and we keep our promises, and we'll do that. Of course, we are encouraging countries that have large amounts of doses to make those available, as well as the companies to go ahead and serve the international market at the same time they serve the wealthy markets. That is really the challenge that's in front of us. The last thing I'd say is that we worked hard to get technology transfers, a lot of them to India. So the doses that are being used in India now are being doses that were being made to be used around the world. Of course, we understand the need. And so we're trying to diversify to other manufacturers to make sure that, you know, we have enough producers around the world to make the doses that are necessary.
And Archbishop, you know, obviously, you know, there is this massive, massive crisis in India right now. Their own, you know, Serum Institute has had to stop exporting. They have a shortage of absolutely everything, and it's beginning to spread across their borders. So given that we know how lethal and contagious it can be if not controlled and if vaccines aren't taken, I wonder what you would say to people on your own continent, Africans, even African leaders, who some of them, for instance, the late president of Tanzania, have played it down. You know, he told people that God would protect them. I know you're a man of God, but it takes more, right? It takes practical social distancing and masks and all the rest of it. And we hear that so much hesitancy is causing even those supplies of vaccines that are on your continent to either expire or have to be thrown away. So there's a whole nother level of crisis to address on your continent.
Perhaps let me predicate that by saying and underscore what you also said in your comment. I think Gavi and the G7 and the others should really also put moral pressure to bear on the World Trade Organization to relax the trips and to really encourage the technology share how we are playing our part on some of those non-pharmaceutical interventions like social distancing, washing our hands and putting our masks, even in those communities where water and sanitation in the continent is still a big problem. And if you look at those leaders that are saying no to vaccines, that are saying this is an act of God, in the continent, in the main, they are a very small minority. Because in the continent, we know we've been vaccinated for polio, for TB, and we continue to have struggle with malaria, and we've been vaccinated for Ebola. So, you know, vaccine reluctancy will not be that big in the continent. Of course, there'll be skeptics there and there. We will say it from the pulpit. We will say it from our shuls. We will say it from the mosque. We will say it from our schools and universities to say, to encourage people to get their jab when it is available. At the moment, indeed, the trickle that has come into the continent is insignificant. We need the know-how. If you look, if I may put another point, if you look at the amount of money, even if it's not for COVID, that the continent spent on exporting drugs, I'm sure if we had the know-how, we could encourage pharmaceutical companies in the continent to produce their own drugs and then to scale up the production, because all these companies cannot manage to scale up.
Okay, so let me just put that last question to you, Seth Berkley. First of all, the hesitancy, how bad is that around the world? But also, we do know that the head of the Africa CDCs has said that they rely on 99% of their vaccines are imported. They only are able to do something like 1%. So no continent can survive in a healthy way if 99% of what they need has to be imported.
You know, vaccines are very special things. They're biologics, living things, and they're quite complicated to make. And so what it requires is a long-term plan and investment. And Africa should have more facilities. We actually procure yellow fever vaccine from a manufacturer in Senegal. There's manufacturers in South Africa, but certainly more needs to be done. The challenge right now, and the WTO is getting involved, is to make sure there are tech transfers that go on. The challenge here is not intellectual property, it's know-how, and it's making sure that companies work together to quickly scale up manufacturing and make adequate amounts of doses. That's what we've done with the Serum Institute of India and other manufacturers in Korea, other places around the world, to get the doses started, and we need to do more of that to get to the tripling of global production of vaccines that we're going to need if we're going to cover everybody.
Well, look, I really appreciate you coming on, Seth Berkley and Archbishop Makhabo, with this urgent call. So thank you both. Now, earlier this month, I spoke with Blake Bailey, author of a blockbuster new biography of Philip Roth, who himself is a complicated writer shadowed by allegations of misogyny. Take a listen.
Philip was quite capable of sexually objectifying women and making incredibly tasteless jokes about it, many of which he put into his books, especially Savage Theater and Portnoy. I think Philip, you know, is the greatest chronicler of the American Jewish experience of the post-war era. And I think it would be a shame if he became unfashionable or was even canceled. Because, you know, I mean, of the 31 books he published, some are absolutely essential reading.
Now, subsequently came shocking news that Bailey faces accusations of his own, that he sexually assaulted multiple women. He says the allegations are, quote, categorically false and libelous. Now, Bailey's publisher, W.W. Norton, says that it is permanently pulling the Roth biography from print. It's an extraordinary development that raises serious questions. Is it appropriate for Norton to cancel the book's publication? And if, as alleged, Norton knew of an assault by Bailey back in 2018, why did they choose to publish in the first place? Author and journalist Rebecca Traister reports extensively on links between power and alleged abuse, from Harvey Weinstein to Andrew Cuomo, and she is joining me now from New York. Rebecca Traister, let's first just talk about the latest news which came today, W.W. Norton pulling all copies out of print. Tell me what you think about that, and is that the right way to go?
That's the hardest question of all, because for me, in writing about issues of power abuse along gendered and racial lines, The question always seems to come, so what should the consequences be? And that's the thing that's the hardest for me to answer. I mean, I think that part of what we're looking at is that you can't fix these problems through just individual censure, right? This is systemic. And of course, there are all kinds of concerns about taking away art made by problematic people who've behaved in abusive ways. If you removed all the art, the books, the movies, the music made by people who have caused harm, not just have been like problematic, but who've caused harm, we would be left with not a lot of art. And so that's problematic. By the same token, in this case, you have a situation where a publisher and an author who all knew that these allegations were potentially going to be a problem, are, if the book stays in publication, are profiting from it. So the questions of what is an appropriate repercussion when somebody is credibly alleged of abuse, harassment, or harm, that's a really difficult question. I certainly don't have the answer. And it's my least favorite part of the conversation because it sort of leaves those who want to have the conversation about this is really problematic and there's a lot of inequity and injustice and abuse happening with the hardest task of all, which is being the sentencers, you know, the executioners.
Right. So let's take it piece by piece. Let's just first talk about the specific allegations. He's accused by two women of rape and of grooming his pupils when he was an eighth grade teacher. He, as I said, denies all this, calls them categorically false and libelous. He said that to the New York Times. His lawyer told us today the allegations against Mr. Bailey are demonstrably false. Many of the complainants against Mr. Bailey have remained on friendly terms with him for the past 20 years, long after the alleged assaults. Philip Roth, the biography, has been published in 9 countries, and only W.W. Norton in the United States has stopped publication, based on nothing more than unproven allegations they have seen in news reports. So, of course, my first question to you is, Norton apparently knew of the allegations. They didn't just see them in news reports or in our interviews or whatever. They apparently knew because one of the complainants told them, I think maybe anonymously, but in 2018. So I guess, you know, then where does the responsibility lie? Should Norton have done something different rather than just publish and hope this never comes up?
Yes. And here we get to these. So again, so often when we talk about Me Too or issues of sexual harassment or power abuse, they come out in these individual stories about Blake Bailey, about people who allege that he raped or assaulted them or groomed them inappropriately. But in fact, the kind of thing that has allowed this behavior to flourish as a norm, this is a systemic problem. And what that means is that while there are individuals who may have caused harm and been harmed, the ability for that to be so rampant, to define so many of the stories that we are talking and thinking about, not only in publishing, but in politics, in art, in media, in all kinds of professions, it's because abuses of power are structural and systemic. And so when you talk about that and how it applies to the Norton, Bailey, Roth situation, what you can see is issues of dependency, first of all, because when somebody who has power and is in a position to abuse it, one of the things that they can do is actually people become dependent on them. So that may mean that it's your boss and you're dependent on your boss who may be abusive for a paycheck or a promotion or a recommendation, which if you have less power than your boss, makes it hard for you to tell an incriminating story or to tell the truth about the boss. In this case, that dependency was Roth, who, as you say, is a man who has famously, let's say, inequitable expressed views about women and gender and sex, and that's in his fiction. And it's debatable in his fiction, and it doesn't mean it's bad to enjoy his fiction. It means it's worth talking about in his fiction, and it's not a secret. He chose, and Blake Bailey was always open about the fact that he was chosen by Roth to be his biographer in part because of a shared attitude toward women. That a story that Bailey told himself was that they bonded over the objectification of the actress Ally McGraw. So he chose Bailey to be his biographer. And then Bailey got access to him, to his papers, to all of this raw material about Philip Roth. And then Norton is dependent on Bailey as the possessor of all this information. And so publishing has profited from Philip Roth himself, and Philip Roth has profited. Blake Bailey profits. Norton profits depend on Blake Bailey. So everybody's dependent on who had all this power, and it offers a degree of protection and immunity to those at the center who may have abused their power in any way. So yes, I think Norton bears tremendous responsibility. Norton behaved, according to reports, very poorly. Not only did they not take action against Bailey, they forwarded the complaint to him, so he was aware of it, and that also sent a message to him that they weren't going to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. They published his book anyway. Why would he think that it would be a problem? His publishers had been informed.
Right. So I got to just get to their response for a second, Rebecca. There has been a leaked internal email from the president, Julia Ridehead, who says, as a publishing company, we are limited in our investigative abilities, but we recognize that there may be situations such as allegations of potentially criminal conduct where we should actively consider bringing in outside assistance. Is that it?
Well, sure, but that's the beginning of it. That's a lot of sort of post hoc covering. They didn't even, according to the reports that I've read, they didn't even reach back out to the complainant. And so whether or not they should have hired a separate investigator, the choice they made was very actively on behalf of Blake Bailey. They let him know that the allegation existed. They transmitted a message. He knew who it was. He knew who this person was, even though she'd submitted her claim anonymously. He, in fact, contacted her afterward in response to the forwarded email. They behaved abominably, and it wasn't just about whether they hired an outside investigator. They didn't even follow up to ask her a question, to ask for more information, to ask for any backup. So I'm not persuaded by that defense.
So I want to ask you, because the real issue is, what does this, well, clearly why it matters, we know why it matters. Why does this discussion matter to our viewers, to people who would buy the book, to people who, you know, are tangentially also then involved in this situation? And I think one of your early experiences during when you were a young reporter, you still are, in any event, in your earlier days, when you were doing a report on Harvey Weinstein and it turned pretty ugly and you know, your colleague was physically, you know, assaulted by him. It's very instructive. Just quickly tell us that story.
I was a 25-year-old reporter. It was 2000, and I was reporting a film business story about Harvey Weinstein and his distribution of a movie. And I went to a public event, a party, to ask him a question because he hadn't returned my calls. And he responded very aggressively toward me. He screamed at me, threatened me, used vulgar language, tried to take my tape recorder away, caused a big public scene. It wasn't subtle. Everybody in the room, he was bellowing. And then took a colleague of mine out into the street, who challenged him on his behavior, into the street and put him in a headlock. And the reason that I think that incident is instructive is because when we talk about these kinds of power abuses, so many people say, well, why didn't they come forward earlier? Here was an incident that happened in public. It wasn't sexual harassment. It wasn't sexualized in any way. But there were lots of reporters there. It got reported in the New York Times. It got reported in the New York Post. It was not a secret that this happened. I was told by my boss that I was not supposed to speak to reporters about it. And so it got framed as I had been the aggressor, a 25-year-old reporter asking a question of this massively powerful movie producer who had been violently aggressive in response. But the message that was sent to me experiencing that, because it was reported and no one cared, it didn't make a scratch on Harvey Weinstein's reputation. In fact, we have so normalized these kinds of abuses that it all got pulled into a kind of romanticized version of his genius and his old style studio boss. You know, we in politics, in film, in art, we confuse often, we've been told to confuse and normalize violence and abuse with genius and power, and, you know, he knows how to play a hard-knuckled game, and he has great business acumen, and he's tough, and that's why he screams at people or behaves in abusive or inappropriate ways. But the ease with which an event like that was normalized and didn't make a dent in the reputation of this man, who, of course, later we would learn had been engaged in massive violent predation against women in other ways. That's part of the message. That's part of how this keeps happening, is that it can be out in the public and we're told it doesn't matter. That's just part of what power looks like.
Rebecca Traister, thank you so much. And you're absolutely right. We have to keep vigilant and keep the accountability up because you're right, it does get normalized. Thank you for having this conversation with us. Now, this week, the Department of Homeland Security announced that it'll be conducting an internal review to root out white supremacy and extremism within federal agencies. Jay Johnson was the Pentagon's chief legal officer, and he then served as Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama. And now he tells Walter Isaacson what lurks in the shadows.
Thank you, Christiane, and Jay Johnson, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me back again. Look forward to our conversation.
10 years ago this weekend was the raid on Osama bin Laden. That was the security threat at that time. Tell me, what role did you play and how do you see that now transforming the type of security threats we face?
May 1st, 2011, I was general counsel of the Department of Defense. I was the senior legal official for the Department of Defense, involved in the consideration of the legal issues that went into the planning of that very sensitive operation. May 1st, 2011 was probably my single best day in public service because we got bin Laden. I'm a New Yorker. 20 years ago on 9/11, I was in this law firm in my private life, the same firm I'm with now, on the other corner of this building, and I saw everything that happened on 9/11. So May 1st, 2011 was a sense of closure for me, like it was for a lot of other Americans. And I'm proud that I had a small part in that. The threat to our homeland security over the last 10 years has evolved significantly. We took the fight to overseas groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. We addressed foreign-directed terrorist attacks to the point where, in my judgment, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, could no longer launch a large-scale attack on our country like a 9/11. We went from there to what we referred to as foreign-inspired attacks, where a lone wolf actor here in the U.S. is inspired by something they see on the internet, to now domestic-based terrorist attacks by violent right-wing extremists, as is documented by the ADL and other groups. So over the last 10 years, since the bin Laden operation, the threats to our homeland have evolved significantly from a foreign terrorist organization like ISIS to now a domestic-based threat of the type we've been discussing, violent right-wing extremists. Like El Paso, like Charleston, I put Charleston in that category, and a series of others, attacks on mosques, on synagogues, on black churches. The ADL has been tracking this for years, and they will tell you that that now is the principal terrorist threat to our homeland. Beyond the terrorist threat, the number one homeland security threat, the immediate threat right now is, of course, COVID, and we're addressing that. People are getting vaccinated. The trend lines are, for the most part, in the right direction. Longer term, it's my view, Walter, that the number one homeland security threat to our nation is global warming, climate change, wildfires in California, drought, famine internationally, eroding coastlines, the severe weather events that threaten aging infrastructure. And we've got a lot of that here in the New York City area. That, in my judgment, is the number one threat to our homeland security. And I'm pleased that the Biden administration internationally is stepping up to taking a leadership role. That's where the United States should be right now in addressing carbon emissions.
You rarely talk about your role that day 10 years ago on the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. Exactly where were you?
I was in the command center in the basement of the Pentagon that day. I remember that not like it was 10 years ago, but like it was maybe 10 hours ago. It was Sunday. I was very apprehensive and nervous, like a lot of other people. I got up very early and went out to the flower shop, the garden shop that morning, planted a whole bunch of pansies in my yard in Georgetown. Then put on a sport coat and went to work. I told my family, I have to go to work today. I'll be back later. And I sat there and listened to and watched the whole operation from the basement of the Pentagon. I took detailed notes, which are now classified. I'll never see again. I'll never forget my entry. I think it was around 3 o'clock. Geronimo, Geronimo, which meant that our special forces had found him and got him.
President Biden is looking at extremists that are in the armed services and the police, even in parts of your former Department of Homeland Security, because there was a high proportion of people who were part of the January 6th insurrection who were part of law enforcement and the military. Tell me how you why that is and how you would solve that problem.
It's a worthwhile inquiry. From what I understand of the announcement the other day, there was no specific episode among DHS personnel, no specific individual who was arrested or anything of that nature acting out on DHS headquarters or something like that. But we do know that a number of the insurrectionists on January 6th were former members of the military, maybe a few in law enforcement. And so it's a worthwhile inquiry to undertake. DHS is actually the largest collection of civilian gun carriers in the federal government, larger than the Department of Justice. It includes Border Patrol, Customs, Air and Marine, the Coast Guard, Homeland Security Investigation. So this is a worthwhile inquiry. But the other thing I want to say in response to your question, Walter, there's a very interesting study out of the University of Chicago by a professor, Robert Pape, you may have heard of it, that studies the demographics of those who were converging on the Capitol January 6th. It shows that a number of them were from blue states, a number of them were from diverse cities, diverse states, and their number one fear and concern was the so-called Great Replacement, that somehow white members of our society were going to be replaced by people of color. That, plus the false belief that somehow the election was stolen, were the principal drivers of this. And it's worth further study, but I do believe that the announcement from DHS was wholly warranted.
You talk about white replacement theory. That seems somewhat prevalent among people in the Border Patrol. In fact, in Facebook groups, people in the Border Patrol have said racist things about even Hispanic members of Congress. What can be done about that?
Well, we don't want to stifle free speech, but there is a point where a Facebook posting, even in your private off-hours capacity, can so degrade and undermine your employer's integrity and mission and credibility that action can be taken. There are decisions in our courts, for example, that say that, sure, everybody has a First Amendment right, but if you're, say, an employee of a public agency, specifically a law enforcement agency, there are some limits to what you should be saying. And when I was secretary, I got to know dozens and dozens of members of the Border Patrol, of DHS personnel. Postings like that, in my experience, are not reflective of the larger attitude within DHS.
Do you think that the Department of Homeland Security and the government should monitor the social media of, like, the Secret Service, the Border Patrol, the Immigration Service? And should it even monitor the encrypted messages, like in encrypted message services?
That's a good question. When we say monitor, that might to some imply surveillance, but in many respects, Facebook postings, Instagram are public. And if I were a member of law enforcement, if I were a member of the Secret Service, and I had a link to, or I had friended somebody else in the Secret Service, and I see them posting things that are ugly, that are extremist, I would probably feel as though we have an obligation to report that to a superior. But, you know, we struggle with this as employers, we struggle with this as leaders of government agencies, how far do you go in measuring the social media conversations of those who work for us? And in this age, I think it is a worthwhile inquiry. There are always limits, there are privacy limits, but I do believe it's a worthwhile inquiry as you apply for a job and while you have a job.
You've said that the border immigration problem, the illegal immigration problem, has a certain tug to it, which is the more a president sounds receptive to having people come to this country, the more people try to get across the border. How do you break that dynamic? And do you see that as being a problem right now with what's happening on our southern border?
Walter, I have to say, I've been away from this problem for 5 years. And the further you get away from it, the easier the solutions seem to become. This was a difficult problem. I owned the southern border issue for 3 years when I was Secretary of Homeland Security. The simple fact is this: under the current conditions, in the current environment in Central America, this is a one-dimensional problem. The more receptive we sound in our immigration policy here in this country, the more the smugglers use that to recruit migrants to come to the United States. There's a push and a pull factor, without a doubt. And so achieving the right balance between promoting our values, being fair, humane in our immigration policy, but also enforcing our immigration laws is delicate, without a doubt. When we had the spike in 2014, I felt obliged to send an unequivocal message: do not come here illegally. You just simply have to send that message. Americans want border security. They want us to treat the Dreamers, for example, fair. They want us to reform our broken immigration system, but we want a secure border. So it's incumbent upon whoever is in power, whichever administration is in power, to send a very straightforward, unequivocal message to people south of the border that there's a right way and a wrong way to come to our country. And if you come here illegally, everyone has a right to claim asylum, but if you come here illegally, we will send you back. You know, when I was in office, I had some very awkward moments. I went to Guatemala. I literally stood next to the president of Guatemala in a press conference and said to his people, "Don't come to my country." It's a little awkward, but we have to send that very straightforward message. Otherwise, the coyotes, the smugglers, will distort a muddled message and encourage people to come. They're like used car dealers, with all due respect to used car dealers. They'll say, "You got to go now. There's a discount. You got to go by the end of the month." And there's this feeding frenzy that leads to large numbers like the ones we're seeing now.
Do you think that the perception of chaos, or the perception, some people even call it a crisis, on the southern border, whether it's real or just perceived, feeds into the white nationalist extremism?
Yes, I do. This is a Republican talking point. They Republicans like to talk about the border. They like to talk about a border out of control, and it feeds anxiety. It's important to understand the facts of illegal migration. And I won't beat around the bush. I think the answer to your question is yes.
If you could wave a wand and change some policies to help with the border issue, which policies would you do, irrespective of the politics of getting them passed?
Well, it's actually not as difficult as waving a magic wand. There are solutions to this. They might be politically unobtainable in this environment, but there are solutions. The simple fact is this, Walter. As long as Central America is in the state it's in, which is one of the most violent regions of our planet, the push factors for illegal migration will always overwhelm whatever defenses you can put up on the southern border. People are making the very basic decision to flee a burning building in Central America, send their children up here, even if it's only for a couple of years while their deportation proceeding, their asylum application, is pending. And so making an investment in addressing the poverty, addressing the corruption, addressing the violence is the way forward. We began that in 2016 with an investment of $750 million. And border security experts will tell you that that drop in the bucket was beginning to make a difference. I know Joe Biden believes this because when he was vice president and I was secretary, we had conversations about this. He spent a lot of time himself in Central America addressing this issue. And long term, that is the solution to this problem. You have to address the push factors.
Do you think that the conviction of Derek Chauvin a week or so ago can help us to get to a better place, both on policing practices and maybe even the larger issue of race?
Two thoughts. One, I'm proud of our court system. Our democracy right now is challenged. It's under stress. But through it all, I think the courts have remained a forum for truth and justice. I was very impressed by the Derek Chauvin jury's methodical approach to the issues. They reached a verdict in 10 hours, but it's apparent that they were very careful. The other thing that occurs to me every time I think about the Derek Chauvin prosecution, Walter, suppose there had been no camera. The initial police report said something like, had a health condition, went into stress while he was handcuffed and died. If there had been no camera, I suspect there would have been no prosecution. There wouldn't have been an indictment. It would have been something tucked in a file and forgotten. As many people note, excessive force, lethal force, unwarranted lethal force by the police is not new. What is new is that it's being filmed now, and it's being filmed on a regular basis. And so there are answers to this problem, but it's a phenomenon that is occurring. We see it occurring on a regular basis, not because it's new, but because the filming of it is new.
Secretary Jay Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, on that very same issue of injustice, last year, artist Amy Sherald was commissioned by Vanity Fair to paint Breonna Taylor just months after she was killed by police. Now imagine her giving away her work to the public rather than selling it to a private collector. Sherald shot to fame in 2018 with her portrait of the First Lady Michelle Obama, which is about to hit the road on tour. And her portrait of Breonna is on display in Taylor's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky right now. And Amy Sherald is joining me to talk about it from her studio in New Jersey. Welcome to the program, Amy Sherald. What an amazing thing. I mean, this portrait, you have decided not to sell off to the highest bidder like you could have done. It's an amazing thing. But to give it to the public commons, if you like, to make a public statement with it. Tell me why that was important to you.
It was important to me because, it was just something I knew I had to do. When I was asked to make this portrait for the cover of Vanity Fair, I had a long conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates about it, and I decided it was the right thing to do. And after the cover was revealed, it was sitting in my studio, and I was thinking about Louisville and all the unrest that had happened there because of Breonna Taylor, and I felt like it could be a bomb in Gilead and a way for people to process through art, what was happening in the community, and maybe find some solace.
I want to ask you about the actual painting itself, because, and I'm going to, play a little bit in a moment from Ta-Nehisi, because I talked to him about this when it was on Vanity Fair's cover last September. But you obviously had communication with Breonna's mother, with her family. You chose to do the colors, the dress, the ring. Tell me how you brought her alive and how you got to know her, because obviously it's the first time you've painted somebody who was no longer alive.
Right. The first thing I did was reach out to her mother, and I asked her to send me some photographs that really represented Breonna's personality. And one thing that she said was that Breonna loved to get dressed up. And so I know as a woman, as a young woman, if I was going to be on the cover of Vanity Fair, I would want to feel beautiful. So the first thing I did was reach out to her mother. I then found a young lady who I'd used for a painting before to pose for me because she was the same height and the same stature as Brianna. And then I reached out to a Black female designer in Atlanta, Georgia, by the name of Jasmine Elder, and started a conversation with her about some of the dresses that I was thinking about. And she was so happy to be a part of the project. She sent me 5 or 6 dresses, and you know, we ended up using one for that painting. As far as the color, it was the hardest choice I felt like I've ever had to make in any of my paintings. It took so long. It was 3 or 4 days of me. I think I saw so many colors that by the end of the day, I didn't know what I had seen, what I liked, and what I didn't like. And I remember walking to the bathroom down the hallway from my studio, and I was just like, Brianna, what color do you want this dress to be? And when I got back, I had was transitioning from one color to another, and the blue on blue came in, and I thought that that was exactly what I was looking for because it allowed the viewer to focus on her face. There's a sense of etherealness that, you know, that encompasses her, heavenliness, and just introspection.
I want to play this bit, as I said, when I spoke to Ta-Nehisi about his commissioning you to do this. And he had talked to Brianna's mother, you know, about what this all meant to her.
When Tamika Palmer, Brianna's mother, when she thinks about her daughter, you know, she's very happy that, you know, she's become a symbol for the movement. But that is her daughter. That's a life. That's, you know, Brianna's not a slogan to her. She's an actual person, you know, somebody she, you know, gave birth to, somebody who she taught how to ride a motorcycle, someone who, you know, she prepared a special, you know, chili recipe with. Someone who was, you know, as she said, the glue for the family that got everybody together. And it's so important to remember that when these cops kill people, that they kill actual people, that they're not piling up numbers, that these are not digits. These are actual lives, people, children who folks have put energy into, who are completely erased off of the face of the earth.
You know, he puts it so correctly and dramatically, obviously. And I was struck also by the fact that you put the ring on her finger because she hadn't yet received it.
Yes. As soon as Ta-Nehisi and LaToya Ruby Fraser, we were on a Skype just kind of going over the work that she had done in Louisville with the family and the photographs. And when I found out that it was a love story, it really felt like something that had to be included into this painting. So I asked LaToya to send me an image of that engagement ring that Brianna did not know that she was going to get. And I reached out to Tamika Palmer, and she asked Kenny if he was okay with it, and he was absolutely ecstatic about it being included. It just brings another level of meaning to the story.
It really does. And another bigger level of meaning, why you've done this. You know, I read that you weren't able to join the Black Lives Matter protest, that this is part of your protest, if you like, but also part of your commitment to social justice. And the funds, whatever funds accrue, are going to support social justice education.
It's, you know, as an American painter, as a female painter, as a Black female painter, I realize, especially as a Black painter, my responsibility when it comes to, you know, visually representing this American narrative in a way that will allow her story to continue to be retold. And so that's why it was really important for me to make sure that I found the right stewards for this work. And of course it had to be in Louisville. Of course, Beat Museum had to be have some ownership over this painting and it be a part of her community and where her mother resides. But I also felt that it was also appropriate for it to be within an institution in DC, in line of sight of the White House and the National Museum of African American History and Culture. I felt like was the perfect home for it because this is a huge moment and she's become symbolic of this moment. And they will be able to create some context around that narrative in order for her story to continue to be told.
I wonder, Amy, whether you've heard any reaction from people who've seen it, whether it has, you know, had the important impact on people who see it in her hometown. And also because, of course, you shot to fame with your portrait of First Lady Michelle Obama, which is also going on the road. So you're big into, I don't know, is it a teachable moment or what? It's moving this history throughout the country and not just keeping it on the walls of a museum.
Yes, it's true. You know, I mean, I'm not a commissioned artist, but when I'm offered the opportunity to become a part of and create legacy through painting, I think it's something that's really important to do.
It is really remarkable. Amy Sherald, thank you so much indeed for joining us. And of course, Amy Sherald is having her first solo West Coast exhibition in Los Angeles right now. And that is it for us. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.